Our second reading this morning is from Marge Piercy. It's her poem, The Seven of Pentacles. She writes, "Under the sky, the color of pea soup, she is looking at her work growing away there actively, thickly, like grapevines or pole beans, as things grow in the real world slowly enough. If you tend them properly, if you mulch, if you water, if you provide birds that eat insects a home and winter food, if the sun shines and you pick off caterpillars, if the praying mantis comes and the ladybugs and the bees, then the plants flourish, but at their own internal clock. Connections are made slowly. Sometimes they grow underground. You cannot tell always by looking what is happening. More than half of the tree is spread out under the soil, under your feet. Penetrate quietly as the earthworm that blows no trumpet. Fight persistently as the creeper that brings down the tree. Spread like the squash plant that overruns the garden. Gnaw in the dark and use the sun to make sugar. Weave real connections. Create real nodes. Build real houses. Live a life you can endure. Make love that is loving. Keep tangling and interweaving and taking in more, a thicket and bramble wilderness to the outside, but to us, interconnected with rabbit runs and burrows and lairs. Live as if you liked yourself, and it might happen. Reach out, keep reaching out, keep bringing in. This is how we are going to live for a long time. Not always. For every gardener knows that after the digging, after the planting, after the long season of tending and growth, the harvest comes." I want to express my deep gratitude to you for your invitation to be here this morning. And it's so wonderful to be with Eloise and Ginny, who are so active in Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light, and my delight and my prayer to Katie for her new adventure. Let's hope that all goes well. Looking back in my files, I realized that the last time I occupied this pulpit as your guest was Earth Day in 2016, about 18 months ago. And what a different time we are in. In that time of April 2016, Pope Francis's encyclical and his address to the United Nations in New York was still fairly fresh in our minds. The Paris Climate Agreement's ink was just beginning to dry, and the role of President Obama and the Secretary of State John Kerry and the former Vice President Al Gore in creating and manifesting that agreement was news. The Clean Power Plan, the keystone of our commitment to the Paris Agreement, was just working its way through public hearings, some right here in Philadelphia. What a difference 18 months makes. We've had a presidential election just a little over a year ago and a sea change in climate change work. President Trump, who once famously said that climate change was a hoax originated by the Chinese, although the news media will tell us over and over again that his legislative agenda has not moved very far. In fact, around climate change, it's moved a lot. It started with appointments in secretariat positions. Rick Perry as the Secretary of Energy, as the former governor of Texas, he brings a strong, strong commitment to the continuation of the extraction of fossil fuels. Ryan Zinke as the Secretary of Interior, representative from Montana, who's already trimmed back a number of our national park borders. Rex Tillerson as the Secretary of State, former CEO of ExxonMobil, and Scott Pruitt, the Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, who as the Attorney General of Oklahoma was best known for his lawsuits against the agency that he is now the administrator of. The agendas of this new administration have been clear, and their actions of all of these agencies supported by executive orders have been swift. Basically, the energy agenda is to roll back any obstacle from fossil fuel companies' claim to have hampered their development of extraction of coal, oil, and natural gas. Also dismantled incentives and progress towards the transition to reducing greenhouse gases. Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light, of which I'm the executive director, like organizations around the country, faced a decision after last year's election. How do we want to respond? What do we do in the face of strident, deliberate assault on the earth, on hard-won progress, and particularly on society's least of these? In the face of change, our board decided, there are some things that are not changed. When I was last here, I talked about the role of faith communities taking action on climate because it's part of our call to do as people of faith, and that still holds. It has not changed. We talked about the resources that our communities have as long, long histories of scriptures and traditions and rituals, and that has not changed. If there's been any shift in the way in which we do our work, it's that we have a less of a focus on what, because the what keeps changing day by day, and more on the how. How is it that we want to do our work in climate change as people of faith? And the board has been really clear. We want to do our work with respect, imagination, creativity, courage, and prayer. We want to work with new partners and across political and ideological divides. We want to work with climate change as part of all the other issues that are bringing such sadness to so many people in this country. Issues of race, justice, immigration. In other words, we have a new appreciation for the intersectionality between climate change and so many of its progenitors. We have gone about doing this work like the sower, scattering seeds upon the ground, aware that some of it is bound to sprout. We know not how. But I want to highlight this morning for you a few ways that we see sprouts around this country, and some of which we've had a hand in, some of which we've observed and cheered on and shared the good news of. Because the news, my friends, is not all bad or bleak. I want to look first at pipeline actions around the United States. Now, pipelines are key to the conversation about climate change because they represent an infrastructure that ties us to a future with fossil fuel investment. In other words, it's really hard to abandon a pipeline once you've put the money and time and energy and all the permissions into it and established it. The other part to remember with fossil fuels is that it ties our children and our grandchildren to a future dependent on oil and gas flowing through those pipelines. Pipelines have also been proven to be unsafe. They compromise public health. They're dangerous to workers' health. You may be reading right now in the headlines that the XL pipeline this week has spilled over 200,000 gallons of oil. That's on the eve of a decision in Nebraska this week that will determine whether the XL pipeline gets built out to its full its full length. But resistance to pipelines continues, and it's even growing. Like the mustard seed in the parable that's just after the portion that Eloise read this morning, from very small seeds, from those seeds that are cast on the ground and we know not how or if they will grow. In fact, there's all kind of action going on. I like particularly this modern sort of interpretation of the sower of the seeds. They buried us, but they didn't know we were seeds when they put us in the ground. They buried us, but they didn't know when we were put in the ground that we were seeds. So the prime resistors of pipelines across this country are those peoples that we have tried to bury over and over and over again. The Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota are Native American peoples that we have tried so hard in this country to bury. And Keystone XL pipeline, it's been tribal leaders and farmers that have resisted the most. And here, close at hand, just in a county or two down the road in Lancaster County, it's the adorers of the Blood of Christ who have been resisting the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline by building, I kid you not, an outdoor chapel in the middle of a cornfield in the way of that pipeline. You try to stop those women religious. Can't do it. Each of these is a product of seeds and is continuing to plant more. I want to spend just a little bit of time this morning reading to you some of the reflection from Pennsylvania Interfaith and Power and Light board member John Creasy. John is a Presbyterian minister and an urban farmer in Pittsburgh. And 1 year ago, exactly today, he stood with the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota to observe the water protectors and to help them in one of the most violent days that occurred in that area. These are John's words. He writes, according to the Treaty of Fort Laramie from 1851, the Sioux Nation has rights to the land between the Cannonball River and the Heart River. Energy Transfer Partners, the company building the Dakota Access Pipeline, has already built the pipeline against federal laws, orders from President Obama, and against orders from the Army Corps of Engineers through the disputed Sioux land, and is now illegally digging under the Missouri River. Remember, this was a year ago. They have ripped a huge swath of destruction through ancient Indian burial grounds, dug under the beautiful Heart River, and now have begun digging under the Missouri River. Highway 1806 runs north from both Sacred Stone Camp and the Ochadi Shakodi Camp. I hope that pronunciation is relatively good, and across the Cannonball River. The bridge crossing the river is the front line of protest, prayer, and conflict. The Morton County Police have blocked passageways north using two burnt-out dump trucks, razor wire, Jersey barriers. They've also staged military vehicles at the north side of the bridge. It's here at the north side of the bridge where water protectors gather regularly to pray and protest the pipeline. It's their belief that the Morton County Sheriff's Department is illegally and unjustly protecting Energy Transfer Partners as they complete the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's their belief that the only way to stop the pipeline is to bring awareness to what is happening and continue to push for legal and political action. That is the fight of all people, John writes, all over the world, this Advent season we can participate in. But the fight on the front lines is not only political, not only phone calls, emails. The fight on the front line is a real physical battle against the completion of the pipeline. Protectors are using their bodies sacrificially to bring awareness that the forces of empire will stop at nothing to finish the pipeline as quickly as possible. On Sunday, November 20th, a group of indigenous young adults from the camp took action to remove one of the burned-out dump trucks. The elders had asked the young indigenous leaders not to take direct action on the bridge while they continued the legal fight, but action was taken against the will of many of the elders. John writes, "I don't think anyone expected the response that was coming from the Morton County Police and their hired mercenaries." At about 27 degrees outside, tear gas and pepper spray were not the dangerous weapons. The National Guard's water cannons brought the threat of extreme hypothermia. The water cannons soaked the crowd. Ice began to form on razor wire. Icicles glittered in the bright lights of the National Guard. An ice skating rink formed on the roadway, making movement difficult for anyone trying to get out of the way of the onslaught from the police. Soaked protectors were not dissuaded. That evening became the night when the world paid attention, even if just for one night, to the abuses and injustice at Standing Rock. Whether you think the police force was justified or not, the abusiveness of those giving the orders as they illegally continue their work cannot be questioned. John continues, "I prayed at the sacred fire, 'Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on us.' With tears in my eye, feeling like something bad was about to happen, I stayed until a call for blankets came. Several of us carried boxes of blankets down the highway to the front lines where protectors were being carried out of the crowd on stretchers, freezing and often incapacitated. They were wrapped in blankets laid in the middle of the highway. No longer were we being attacked with water cannons and tear gas, but rocket-propelled concussion grenades were being shot into the crowd, and police were taking aim at civilians with guns loaded with rubber bullets. Cars, trucks, and vans pulled onto the bridge to carry the injured back to camp, but the medical tents could not house all of the hurt. That night, 300 people were injured and 23 taken to area hospitals, many with hypothermia." John finishes, he says, "I'm not sure that night should have happened, but it did. The elders asked for no direct action for a 30-day period, but that action and the brutal police response brought more awareness around the world that law enforcement will not stop at putting up barriers, but will take any action necessary to protect the pipelines. Native Americans are fighting not only for clean water in the Missouri River, they are fighting for you, for your children, for the generations to come who will inherit the earth that we leave for them. The Dakota, Lakota, Nakota, and over 300 other Native nations are fighting to push our world toward a future where all human life is honored and where every inch of Grandmother Earth is treated as sacred space. They are taking every risk they can, putting their health and lives on the line for their people and for all people. Direct action is risky. It's not always pretty. It's not always done at the right time or place, but in the face of empire, we all need to take direct, peaceful, nonviolent action to push back the veil of injustice." The Standing Rock Sioux are buried seeds indeed. We see it as our role in Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light to nurture these seeds wherever we find them. Closer to home, and from our reading from Marge Piercy and the lessons that she calls to us from the natural world to penetrate quietly, to fight persistently, to spread and overrun, to gnaw in the dark, she says. This is the power that we need to tap into. And sometimes it's the power of adversaries to inspire and inform our action. This past August at the Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light Board Retreat, I introduced a practice to our board called Touching the Earth for Our Adversaries. It comes from Thich Nhat Hanh's community, and it begins in gratitude for the earth and to the earth. And it continues from there, gratitude to our enemies. Our enemies. yes, our enemies, and how they help us see how much we love this planet, and how that love calls us to transform our pain and our anger into love of beauty for all of life. Adversaries, yes, adversaries like EPA Administrator Pruitt and Secretary Zinke and Perry, they show us what we are capable of as human beings. If we allow ourselves to be governed by fear and separation, by greed, we are all capable of being just like them. But if we learn from them and take our gratitude from the love that we feel for this planet because of what they are asking us to do to it, we come up with a very powerful practice. One of our board members, Peter Winslow, took this practice of bowing to our adversaries. He took it to the SEPTA board meeting a few weeks ago. We have been working with 3to50.org to try and stop the development of a natural gas plant in the Nicetown area of Philadelphia, a neighborhood that is already impacted by so many pollutants, by such compromised air and water quality. And Peter went to the board meeting and said, "I'm going to start my comments, my public testimony, by thanking you as my adversary for reminding me why I do this work and how much I love this planet." There's a YouTube video of it, and it's pretty powerful to watch the SEPTA board watching one man bow down and touch the earth as he praises his adversaries. Marge Piercy reminds us that connections are made slowly, but the harvest does come. And of course, the parable of the sower is really about faith and its ability to grow. When we're not watching, when we have our backs turned, when we are asleep, the point is to keep putting the seeds out there over and over and over again. To join together with the Higgins of the world on their dreams, to jump in the bucket and not be the only drop in the bucket, and to have faith that doing the right thing, how we do things, doing the right thing will eventually bring about the kingdom of God that we all yearn for. Higgins' dream only came to pass because others believed in it. And Higgins' story reminds us of one of the most important tenets of working on climate change that I shared with the children. If you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And it's in that spirit that I'm going to invite you to find that blue drop that you were handed as you came in this morning. This is part of a project that the Shalom Center in Mount Airy has invited us to be a part of. Their image is that we will flood the EPA with messages, messages of concern and messages of hope. If you look at this, you can imagine that this is the shape of a water drop, as Elliot reminded us in children's time. It's also the shape of a teardrop. We have pain and lament in this time. We have hopes and dreams in this time. And so I invite you to take a few minutes and write on one side a lament, a concern, a sadness that you might be carrying about the climate in these times, and then to turn it over and write a dream, a hope, a commitment, a desire. All of these drops are going to be collected. They're going to be strung on a line with a copy of the Higgins story. They're going to be sent to New York Avenue Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., along with messages from all over the country destined for the EPA. And they're going to be walked mindfully, prayerfully from New York Avenue Presbyterian across the street to the EPA and delivered. The idea is to flood the EPA with messages from this country of how badly we need them to do the work of the people. Blessed be, and I believe that we have some music while you spend some time writing.
As we prepare to reflect and write, let's sing together a song of preparation and a song of response to Allison's words.